Church, how's everyone doing? All right, let's have a little energy here today. All right, we've been having a great Sunday so far. We're singing loudly, and the song service has been awesome. So let's get into the Bible, and we're going to spend a little bit of time studying the Scripture. So you can turn your Bibles over to Matthew chapter 5, and you know, we've been studying what is probably the most famous teachings of Jesus, the Sermon on the Mount. And so we're going to continue our way through the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew chapter 5, 6, and 7. But in it, Jesus is teaching his disciples how to live the kingdom life. He's trying to teach his disciples what it means to live really counterculturally. We talked about that a number of weeks ago, that God has always wanted a people that are different than the world, that go against the flow of the world. And so he's teaching his disciples what it looks like to have different values and priorities and thinking than the established culture all around them. And a couple weeks ago, we focused on Jesus' statement, actually in Matthew 5, verse 20, which says, "For I tell you that unless your righteousness surpasses that of the Pharisees and the teachers of the law, you will certainly not enter the kingdom of heaven." And so we talked about that passage a couple Sundays ago, and it is, if you really think about it, it is a jaw-dropping statement that our righteousness is to surpass that of the Pharisees and the teachers of the law. And especially if you consider who the Pharisees and the teachers of the law were, they were sort of the religious elite. And so Jesus is saying people in the kingdom need to be a little bit different than even those that are the elite in the world around us. And so from that statement on, at the end of chapter 5, Jesus clarifies the caliber of righteousness that he calls each and every one of us to. He clarifies what it looks like to be a disciple. And so he goes through six different sets of contrasts between what you might hear in the world around you and what Jesus expects for us as disciples in the kingdom. Over and over, he says, "You have heard that it was said." And then he says, "But I tell you." And so he's not necessarily negating the Old Testament. The Old Testament is good, but he's simply saying, you've heard that it was said about the Old Testament. This is how people understood it and applied it. And now I'm telling you exactly what it looks like to be a disciple in God's kingdom. And Jesus was uniquely qualified to interpret and apply the law. After all, he fulfilled the law and the prophets. And so he did that perfectly. And so he was able to teach exactly what that looks like. And often that means that we are convicted and our hearts are penetrated because of the things that Jesus talked about. And so his overall concern in these number of contrasts, these six different contrasts, is the overall intent and motive of God's law, right? He's getting at what does God really want from us, not just in the externals, but in the actual heart for us to live out as Christians. Sorry, this stand was a little bit uneven over there, so I got a straight one. And so Jesus is going after the heart and the intent that we are to have as disciples, especially in light of the fact that Pharisees and teachers of the law essentially built the roadmap to righteousness for people in his day. They would teach what it looks like to be righteous, and they would show people, and that often meant emphasizing the external obedience, and it often meant neglecting the inner heart transformation that we're supposed to have. And the problem was that Pharisees and teachers of the law were not only living that way as hypocrites, but they were leading other people to do the exact same. And so we need to take Jesus' teaching seriously if we're going to allow our hearts to be changed to be who Jesus wants. And so today we're just going to look at the first one, the first contrast, and we're going to talk about anger. And so we're going to spend the entire day today talking about anger. And I wanted you just to think about this question. Is anger, in and of itself, is it morally good, bad, or neutral? How many people would say anger is morally good? How about how many people would say anger is morally bad? We got one. Anyone say anger is morally neutral? Okay, so we have a lot of neutrals here, and I would actually say that anger is good. Anger is a God-given emotion. God himself gets angry. You know, if you think about the problem with anger is often how and why it manifests itself. When we get angry, if we're as fallen people, as selfish people, we tend to get angry for things that are maybe trivial or self-focused or self-absorbed. Or it may be how anger manifests itself. We get harsh with people or we get violent or whatever it may be. But over and over, we see that anger is actually an attribute of God. And so we read about this passage in Psalm 7, verse 11. It says, God is a righteous judge, a God who displays his wrath every day. And we could find a number of other passages about God. As we look at Jesus, in a number of instances, was angry. Of course, we know when Jesus went into the temple, he starts flipping over furniture, and he displays some anger in that moment, righteous anger. And we also see it, though, in Mark 3, verse 5. It says, he looked around at them in anger and deeply distressed at their stubborn hearts. He said to the man, stretch out your hand. He stretched it out, and his hand was completely restored. In Mark 10, 14, we find out Jesus was indignant when the disciples were hindering the children to come to him. And so at a moment in time, he got angry at that time. And you might be tempted to say, well, that was Jesus. And so his anger may have been good. It may have been justified. But as for you and I, there's no way that my anger could ever possibly be good. And that may be true. But we also read about the Apostle Paul. And he's a human being just like you and I. And it says in Acts 17, verse 16, while Paul was waiting for them in Athens, he was greatly distressed to see that the city was full of idols. And that word greatly distressed means to be stirred up or provoked to anger. That the Apostle Paul was actually aroused to wrath because as he looked around the city, what he saw was idols. He saw God's substitutes and he saw people worshiping false gods instead of the true God. And what it led Paul to do, this is why anger can be a good thing, is it actually prompted him to begin reasoning in the synagogue and teaching the good news of Jesus and the resurrection. And we probably need a lot more righteous anger in the world today. It's probably not uncommon for somebody to be telling some sort of conflict in their marriage or their family, and somebody looks at them and says, you seem rather calm, aren't you getting angry about that? And they might respond and say, well, I was taught as a kid that you should never be angry. Actually, there's a time to get angry. And actually, it's a good thing if it prompts us to do something like Paul, that we reason. See, Paul didn't fly off the handle. He didn't start cursing. He didn't start throwing around things. He simply reasoned because there was an issue at stake. The stakes were extremely high. And so we certainly need more righteous anger in the world. What if great men and women in the Bible never got angry? A lot of good would not have been done. But the truth of the matter is, we, in our own experience, we know that anger is damaging and it ruins lives, it's tinted by sin, and we often resist the real possibility of having righteous anger. Because most often when we see anger, it's uncontrolled and incredibly destructive. That's the most common experience that most of us have with anger. And so it's easy to go, is anger good or bad? Oh, it's bad. Because we've seen it destroy relationships and lives. It's an incredibly powerful emotion. And so if we're to actually have righteous anger, we're going to need the Holy Spirit to do a lot of work in our lives and in our hearts to actually have the right type of anger. And so we may see anger when maybe dad flies off the handle and gets upset at the kids. We might see it when mom starts barking at her young kids and strips them of their confidence. We might see it when a husband gives the cold shoulder for a couple weeks because he's angry. Or maybe a wife shouts venomous words at her husband right in front of the kids. and it begins slowly creating problems in families and even in churches. Because anger is so powerful that if it's uncontrolled, it creates all sorts of damage. You know, probably if we've, maybe in the last week, we've had some sort of conflict or anger, we may go into the next couple days after that sort of conflict, and we imagine that the problem is actually resolved, and we imagine it because probably our emotions have died down, and life has forced us to be a little bit more calm because we have to go to work the next day and we can't be screaming at the boss, right? And so there's sort of a built-in sense of decorum. There's an appropriate way to behave, and so we're forced to control it a little bit. But it's quite possible that we're just imagining the problem is resolved. And the relationship now carries a stress fracture into the distant future. The real issue wasn't dealt with. You coasted over it to cope with life. And now you're vulnerable to all sorts of problems. The next time someone looks at you the wrong way, you're going to blow up on them. And anger becomes really damaging. Let's read in Matthew chapter 5 and verse 21. Because most often our experience with anger is that of unrighteous anger, Jesus makes a point in the Sermon on the Mount to get right to the heart of the matter. And in verse 21 it says, "You have heard that it was said to the people long ago, 'You shall not murder, and anyone who murders will be subject to judgment.' But I tell you that anyone who is angry with a brother or sister will be subject to judgment." Again, anyone who says to a brother or sister, "Raka," is answerable to the court. And anyone who says, "You fool," will be in danger of the fire of hell. Therefore, if you're offering your gift at the altar and there remember that your brother or sister has something against you, leave your gift there in front of the altar. First go and be reconciled to them, then come and offer your gift. Settle matters quickly with your adversary who is taking you to court. Do it while you're still together on the way, or your adversary may hand you over to the judge, and the judge may hand you over to the officer, and you may be thrown into prison. Truly, I tell you, you will not get out until you have paid the last penny." And so Jesus here begins to clarify the sixth commandment. You shall not murder. And Jesus basically takes time to contrast the word on the street. Right, the Old Testament clearly said you shall not murder, but the next phrase about anyone who murders will be subject to judgment is essentially distilling a number of passages in the Old Testament. That was the way they interpreted and understood what it meant. And so he contrasts the word on the street with his authoritative pronouncement that we are not to get angry, or some of your translations may say angry without cause. And you probably could insert the word angry without godly cause. Because it's extremely easy to think that our cause is justifiable. And our reason why I got angry, you know, they said this thing or they did that certain thing and it ticked me off so bad. And we think that it's justifiable. But Jesus tells us that if anyone gets angry with a brother or sister, they will be subject to judgment. And really behind that pronouncement is the understanding that God created human beings to bear the image and likeness of God. That all life, Christian or non-Christian for that matter, has value and worth because we were created to bear the image of God. And so even getting angry on someone and blowing up on them is a way of maybe identity theft. You're stripping away their value and worth as a person created by God. He talks about three things. One, he talks about anger specifically, which is essentially the source of physical murder. Everyone that's actually murdered someone, it started with anger in the heart. But then he gives another specific example, maybe to clarify the anger, and he says, again, anyone who says to a brother or sister, Raca, is answerable to the Sanhedrin. And that term, Raca, is an Aramaic term of contempt. It's maybe the equivalent of saying, you empty-headed person. It's a way of saying, you blockhead, you numbskull, you nitwit. I'm not calling you any of that by that. Just to clarify. It's a term of contempt, basically calling people, you dummy. You idiot. What are you doing? And then he says, the third one is, and anyone who says, you fool, which the Greek word is more, that's probably not how you pronounce it, but it comes from the word moros, which is where we get our English term moron. So some of your translations, I think if you have a Holman Christian Standard Bible, it probably says, you moron. And so, you blockhead or numbskull or nitwit is basically contempt for someone's head, where you fool is a contempt for their heart. One saying you're stupid, while the other is saying you scoundrel. You idiot. I can't believe you live that way. You know, how often do we treat people with such contempt? You know, we imagine anger to be sort of this explosive thing that maybe creates a scene in public, but maybe it's more relevant and convicting and penetrating for some of us to think about how often do you show such blatant disregard for another person? How often do you show such derision or distaste for another human being? Maybe you might say something like, you know, I just don't like that brother or sister. And so, in the fellowship, I just kind of stay away from them. I just try not to talk to them. What contempt for another person whose blood Jesus shed for them? Or maybe we might think about, you know, speaking of non-Christians at work, or maybe in your extended family or something like that, and we might just think, you know, I just don't even like being around them. We might think, oh, those non-Christians, they just never can get it right. They got false doctrine, they're always cursing at work. You know, oh, homosexuality. And we show this contempt, not for the sin, but for the person. How are you ever going to love them into the kingdom of God if we have that heart? How are we ever going to sit down and study the Bible with them and have any sort of persuasion with them if in our heart we have contempt? If our heart, we don't think they're worth our time. And so Jesus gets right at the heart of the matter as he addresses these different things. He goes on and he gives two different illustrations, and the point is essentially the same. It's settle matters quickly. Be quick to resolve problems. Don't waste time, you know, just harboring anger within your own heart. But settle matters quickly. And I had just an observation as I thought about this, is I think people tend to be quick to anger and slow to resolve conflict. And God calls us as his kingdom people to be completely different, to be slow to anger and quick to resolve conflict. Think through some of these different scriptures all throughout the Bible. I was just amazed as I read all these different passages how often it talks about God wanting us to be slow to anger. And so we might read James 1, we know this one. My dear brothers and sisters, take note of this. Everyone should be quick to listen, slow to speak, and slow to become angry, because human anger does not produce the righteousness that God desires. So we should be quick to listen, slow to speak, and slow to become angry. How about 1 Corinthians 13, this great passage about love? And it says, love is patient, love is kind. It does not envy, it does not boast, it is not proud, it does not dishonor others, it is not self-seeking, it is not easily angered. It keeps no record of wrongs. So love, Christ-like love, is not easily angered. We should not be walking around on eggshells around each other, because it would be pretty hard to offend a disciple of Jesus. You know, all these different Proverbs. Proverbs 14, verse 29, it says patience, but the phrase in Hebrew is slow to anger, or something to that effect. And so, whoever is patient has great understanding, but one who is quick-tempered displays folly. To be slow to anger, that demonstrates you have great understanding. But quick-tempered people, what folly is in that? Proverbs 16:32, better a patient person than a warrior, one with self-control than one who takes a city. Here's Proverbs 19:11, a great one. It says, a person's wisdom yields patience. It is to one's glory to overlook an offense. Right? It's a great thing to be able to go, okay, there is an offense, there is a problem here, but it's not that big of a deal. If there's so much anger that's built up and you're not being able to figure out why it's there and resolve it, then a conversation needs to be had. But if you can just overlook it and move on with life, there's great glory in that. How about Proverbs 15? You might not be able to read that very well. It says, a hot-tempered person stirs up conflict, but the one who is patient calms a quarrel. Isn't that the way that it always is that it's the one that's slow to anger, the one that's patient, that can calm down a tense situation. Whereas the person that's hot-tempered, all it does is they're pouring fuel on that quarrel. They're just breathing life into that fire. And then we read Proverbs 15:1, a gentle answer turns away wrath, but a harsh word stirs up anger. And so the hot-tempered person, of course, when they're so hot-tempered and they're so quick to get angry, harsh words begin coming out. And all of a sudden now they're stirring up anger in the other person. What do? Now they're going to start giving into harsh words. And so what you have is, my attitude affects my behavior, which affects their attitude, which affects their behavior. And so you have this vicious cycle that goes around and around and around until you get to crisis stage. And it would be so good if somebody had the calmness of mind to give a gentle answer. If they could just take a syringe of humility and inject it into the cycle for just a moment in time. If we'd have the attitude of, I'm going to outlast your harsh words. I'm going to be so slow to anger that you can be as harsh as you want. But I'm going to listen, I'm going to hear you out, and then I'm going to respond with a gentle answer. And we'll destroy the entire cycle. Now, this is such a problem that actually in Proverbs 22, verse 24 and 25, it says, do not make friends with a hot-tempered person. Do not associate with one easily angered, or you may learn their ways and get yourself ensnared. So even people that maybe generally are pretty slow to anger, when they get in this quarreling cycle with someone else, all of a sudden now it's stoking the flames. And now they're just getting involved in the trap that they set up for themselves. You know, if you think about anger like this, these are the two maybe problems with anger. These are the two unhealthy extremes of anger, is either you clam up or you blow up. And probably everyone in this room has one tendency one way or the other. And probably even more than that, the person that blows up think they have victory when they clam up. Right? They typically blow up and cause all sorts of damage. And so, man, if I could just not do that for a little bit and show a little bit of decorum, a little bit of politeness for a time being. But in reality, all they're doing is clamming up. They're not slow to anger. They're quick to listen and slow to speak, but not slow to anger. And so these are the two unhealthy extremes. When you clam up, what you end up destroying is yourself. Right? Anger is like a stick of dynamite. And If you clam up and bottle it up, it destroys yourself. But if you blow up, who do you destroy? Everyone around you. And so you either destroy yourself or the other person. But what's not destroyed? The problem. What's actually not destroyed? The sin. And God's anger is the type of anger that actually deals with the problem. And the anger that God gives us is, it's typically generated because there is an issue. There is some sins one way or the other, or maybe both. But anger is meant to be directed at the problem, not at the person. And we could use it in a godly way. And so instead of clamming up or blowing up, we should speak up. You know, that's probably not even the best way to put it. Because when I say speak up, what I mean is to communicate. To selflessly communicate, which involves listening and hearing another person through. You maybe aren't doing all the talking, but you're working it out. You're resolving the problem. And so what Jesus said in his illustration here in the Sermon on the Mount, he said, settle matters quickly. You know, this is very much the way God's character is talked about throughout the Bible. In Exodus 33 and 34, there's this great story with Moses. And in Exodus 33 and verse 18, Moses says, now show me your glory. He says that to God. Essentially, he's saying, God, reveal yourself to me. Show me who you are. And so God responds, and in verse 19 of chapter 33, he says, and the Lord said, I will cause all my goodness to pass in front of you. And I will proclaim my name, the Lord, in your presence. I will have mercy on whom I will have mercy, and I will have compassion on whom I will have compassion. But he said, you cannot see my face, for no one may see me and live. Then the Lord said, there is a place near me where you may stand on a rock. When my glory passes by, I will put you in the cleft of the rock and cover you up with my hand, until I have passed by. Then I will remove my hand and you will see my back, but my face must not be seen. And so God's not going to show him himself in the fullest measure, but he says, you can see my backside, basically. You can sit in the rock, because if you saw me in all of my glory, you would die. And then in chapter 34 and verse 5 through 7, it says, then the Lord came down in the cloud and stood there with him, and proclaimed his name, the Lord. And he passed in front of Moses, proclaiming, the Lord, the compassionate and gracious God, slow to anger, abounding in love and faithfulness, maintaining love to thousands, and forgiving wickedness, rebellion, and sin. Yet he does not leave the guilty unpunished. He punishes the children and their children for the sin of the parents to the third and fourth generation. And so God himself is slow to anger. We're to be the type of people that are slow to anger so that anger can be used the right way. And in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus tells us these two illustrations. I'll read them one more time. In verse 23 of chapter 5, therefore, if you're offering your gift at the altar, and there remember that your brother or sister has something against you, leave your gift there in front of the altar. First go and be reconciled to them, then come and offer your gift. Settle matters quickly with your adversary who is taking you to court. Do it while you're still together on the way, or your adversary may hand you over to the judge, and the judge may hand you over to the officer, and you may be thrown into prison. Truly I tell you, you will not get out until you have paid the last penny. What is Jesus's antidote to anger? It's settle matters quickly. Get busy getting resolved as soon as there's any awareness of anger in your heart. These two illustrations, one of going to the temple to offer a sacrifice to God, probably the modern day equivalent. In Jesus' day, the temple was still standing. They were offering sacrifices to God still. But the modern equivalent might be coming to church and halfway through the worship service, you realize, I got a grievance with my brother. And so you get up and you leave in order to resolve the problem. Now, I'd be nervous if everyone left all of a sudden. But the modern equivalent might be something like that. Or it might be, I'm not taking communion until I have a conversation with this brother, because it's still an open can of worms. And so the other illustration is that of going to court and answering charges of an accuser. Maybe the equivalent of having some sort of unpaid debt, and a creditor takes you to court to get his money, and you just make a settlement outside of court. You resolve the problem sooner. And so both illustrations are a little bit different. One's from church, the other's from court. One's from, has to do with a problem with a brother. The other has to do with a problem with an enemy. But the basic lesson is the exact same. Be extremely quick to resolve problems. Reconcile before worship. You know, this phrase that Jesus uses, settle matters quickly, it basically means make friends quickly. So we're not just supposed to kind of skate over a problem with someone, but we're supposed to be the type of peacemakers that actually turn an adversary into a friend. There's a close relationship there. We aren't to drag our feet. We're not to be a slowpoke. We're not to avoid the hard conversation or to be sluggish, but we are to pick up the pace and deal with the things that we need to deal with in our lives. Here's maybe a couple phrases you might need to get really comfortable using. How about, can we talk about dot, dot, dot? If we took one thing, one practical thing away, can we just say, if I have a problem, I'm going to go to that person and say, can we talk about fill in the blank? Or how about, you know, this is how you hurt me, dot, dot, dot. Or if you're the offender, how about, not just I'm sorry, but I'm sorry for dot, dot, dot. Fill in the blank. Or how can I repair the damage? You know, there's a problem when someone says they're sorry and all of a sudden the other person wants to keep talking about it, and the one that says they're sorry all of a sudden goes, don't you forgive me? Why do we have to keep talking about it? Okay, you're not sorry. It's not resolved. So until you can say, how can I repair the issue? We need to get really comfortable saying things like that. Or how about lastly, I forgive you. Get resolved. If we just have a vision in the Fort Wayne Church that we're going to settle matters quickly, how much problems can we avoid? How much drama? How much suspicion of the other person? If we would just do what Jesus says. Lastly, in Matthew chapter 5 and verse 9, it says, blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called children of God. That if we deal with anger the godly way, we are being like our Father in heaven. We're being peacemakers. And so let's be peacemakers like God is, and let's have a blessed rest of the Sunday. Amen?